Joe, do you like to play games?
Yeah. Peter says you have the best games.
Well, I have a game in my house that you might like to play. Would you like that?
Yeah. Okay.
Welcome to this continuation of the Stephen King Night Shift retrospective series.
This will be the best ride of your life, Marty.
Join Garrett.
You did this!
Matt.
I am God here!
And Adam.
This is bullshit, a whole bunch of bullshit.
As they continue to dive into each movie adaptation from King's short story collection, Night Shift.
I am a man of my word.
Contained in this leg of the Stephen King retrospective are the adaptations of Graveyard Shift.
There ain't no way they're going to get this place settled in a week.
The three Mangler movies.
Like I told you, there's no free lunch, no siree, Bob.
And the two Lawnmower Man films.
This is also on you.
Keep checking in as the boys will continue going through each cinematic adaptation of the popular author's work, one movie at a time, in publication order.
How can you do this to me?
All coming up, courtesy of Percolated Media.
I'm in!
The Lawnmower Man, previously known as... Oh, I can't say that, otherwise I'll get sued! Released March 6, 1992. Budget on this was $10 million. Box office, believe it or not, this thing made over $150 million. And this was directed by Brett Leonard. Oh boy, so much to talk about with The Lawnmower Man. You know, we've gone through Graveyard Shift, we've gone through The Mangler. We have a lot to dissect with this one, boys, because after everything, and this is 1992, so this is 2 years after It and Misery, and Kathy Bates had gotten her Oscar 2 years before, so King had some clout around this time. And so I find it amazing that this was the movie where King was like, enough is enough. Movie comes out, and he ends up suing New Line Cinema. Now, New Line Cinema, I said, yes, if anyone's listening to this and has not watched this movie, beginning of this movie has that iconic New Line Cinema logo. I say iconic because me and Adam grew up with the Nightmare on Elm Street films, and this was the thing you saw before all of those films. The person associated with that studio, Mr. Robert Shea, he got the rights to this, and they released the film, and King took them to court and said, you know what? This has almost nothing to do with my story. Robert Shea in court said, well, you know what? We bought the rights to the story. We bought the rights to your name so we can use it. Because in the advertisements, and Adam, I'm sure you remember these, in advertisements, it said from the mind of Stephen King.
Absolutely.
And above the title, it said Stephen King's The Lawnmower Man, which is the little joke I made at the beginning of this.
It's on the ads, those trailers, was Stephen King's The Lawnmower Man.
Yep. Now, by the way, the story is in here, and I'll get to it when I get to it, but this movie comes out, and he wins the suit. He gets a set of money after the lawsuit, right? So Robert Shea does not back down. This motherfucker, the movie makes its rounds in the theaters, comes to video stores, and guess what? The video box says Stephen King's The Lawnmower Man from the mind of Stephen King.
I love Shea.
So Stephen King took them to court again and demanded all merchandise associated with this movie that proclaims it to be from the mind of Stephen King needs to be taken down, or he will be paid $10,000 for each day it remains on the shelf. And the judge agreed. And so that's what made Robert Shea cave in. And yes, that is a huge backstory to a movie that I'm going to say right now is already batshit crazy when you add this background.
Especially because it's not like Stephen King is exactly shy about putting his name on anything he could possibly put his name on.
That's why I said it's crazy that this is what broke him.
Yep.
This is what this is what caused him to say, you know what, enough's enough, I'm suing.
He was 2-0 in court. That's the most impressive thing, that Bob Shea doubled down because he thought he could get away with it. But here's the thing that blows my mind when I did research on my own, because I know this movie is kind of infamous. And the fact that we're even doing it in a Stephen King retrospective might cause us to get sued by Stephen King. So I'm going to put this out there right now. I can't believe this is the one he put up this big of a fuss about. I understand writer's integrity and things being bastardized, but look, by 1992, his stuff had been adapted for over 15 years. And not all of it has been good. In fact, a lot of the stuff we have talked about recently has been pretty terrible. Why did this one stick in his craw so much versus movies like the Mangler sequels later on? I know this kind of set the precedent, but like I think there's movies. And like, he didn't even take Stanley Kubrick to court with how much he hates him. Like,
well, because he had no clout. He had no clout at that time. By this time, he had clout. I think that's what it comes down to.
Well, be that as it may, I can't believe he put up this much of a stick for this fucking movie.
I wonder if any of that came to with the that this was going to be granted, I think it was his first one, to get other media. There was no video game tie-in for Salem's Lot. You know, this was going to get video games and all this other stuff as well. And I wonder if maybe that had something to do with it.
That video game was terrible, too. It was god-awful. It was a Sega CD game.
Well, remember, at movies that caused video games to be made based on the movies, most of those are crap.
Yeah.
E.T.
I remember I had it. It was a Lawnmower Man Sega CD game. I was so excited for it, and I'll get to my theatrical experience here in a bit, but I was so excited because, believe it or not, as a teenager, this movie was the tits for me. Like, I loved this movie to pieces. And so I was excited to get the video game and say, oh my God, like those cool effects, I get to play those? I take this game home, and it's one of those games where like it has scenes from the movie in it, and basically it is minutes after the movie ends, and you're trying to get Job, the Jeff Fahey character, you're trying to defeat him. Pretty much is the entire crux. There is a walkthrough. It is on YouTube. It's about 55 minutes. And I tried watching that just to kind of refresh my memory on it. And I got so much PTSD while doing it. I'm like, okay, I can't do this. Like, it's just, it's bad. And apparently they did a Super Nintendo game as well. But yeah, this one inspired video games. It was very successful. Now, Brett Leonard,
just because this movie inspired how many knockoffs? I swear to God.
Oh, God,
Every generation, there's some guy who thinks, you know what, I'm going to be the person who makes this type of story work. And even this movie, in and of itself, is basically doing what other like generations have done of taking this story and trying to redo it. This is a redux of, you know, two big things that we'll get into in the movie. So even the movie in and of itself, while it's not an adaptation of Stephen King's The Lawnmower Man, it's really an adaptation of something else, just with a virtual spin.
Yeah, that's a great point. And here's the crux of how this movie pretty much came to be, is somebody had the rights to this. I mean, we've discussed it, to the Night Shift stories. And here comes Bob Shea. He grabs the Lawnmower Man up, and he gets in touch with Brett Leonard, who, at this point, he had done one horror film, but he lived in Silicon Valley. So he knew a ton of tech heads, pretty much. So when Bob Shea calls him in his office and says, look, I've seen this horror film that you did. I want you to adapt this. Brett Leonard took a look at the story. He's like, this is 8 pages. I can't do anything with this. Matt, have you read the story to this?
Oh, yeah, it's horrible. Where it's like this fat pan-worshipping thing that's eating grass.
Yes.
Oh, my God, it's so bad. And speaking of Brett Leonard, Adam, do you know what else this guy has done? This is the funniest thing.
Oh, yes, and I don't know which way you want me to go, but one, he does a movie that you might as well make as a pseudo-sequel to this with Garrett, one of our favorite theater watches, Virtuosity.
Yes.
But he also made the most infamous and the start. This is, it is an actual canon movie, and I mean in canon, not Canon Studios. He made Man-Thing for Marvel.
Yes. Which I want
to
cover.
Well, we're going to have to. Yeah. But yeah, this fucking guy made Virtuosity, which basically is the kind of like the Lawnmower Man. I mean, it's very
similar. Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, very much.
In a lot of ways. Not just because you have paid actors embarrassing themselves like you have in this movie. but Man-Thing was Sci-Fi Channel's attempt to do cash in on Marvel success. Like, it didn't even get a theatrical release at a time where Marvel put every property they had in theaters, whether it was as niche as Blade or as big as Spider-Man. But Mantic was so bad, they said, fuck no.
It is a Kevin Feige production, as much as he denies
it. Is.
Yeah, you think he'd sue to take his name off that?
It stars one of the girls from Transformers, too. Oh. You know, he did another one, too, and he has a history of this. Because, now, Jeff Goldblum had a follow-up to Jurassic Park called Hideaway, which is a movie I saw opening weekend, not because of Jeff Goldblum.
But Alicia Silverstone.
But because, yes, because of the other star in that movie, Alicia Silverstone. I was there opening weekend. One of the worst movies I have ever seen. It is so bad. And that's based on a story by Dean Koontz. Guess who else fought to get his name off the fucking title? Dean Koontz fought really hard, but he doesn't have any of the power that King has, so he was not successful.
Yeah, speaking of,
it is still Dean Koontz's
Hideaway.
Speaking
of Hideaway, because it's kind of, you know, it's connected to that front, but not only is that movie bad, Dennis Lehane must love that movie because he basically took the same twist and used it in Shutter Island. It's almost the same thing, and it's literally because you have Alfred Molina in the Ben Kingsley role who explains what the movie's actually about. Please don't watch this movie, people. It's not even fun bad. It's just...
No.
It's so fucking, like, tedious and boring. Mm. It's fucking 2 hours long, which makes sense for The Lawnmower Man, too, because there's 30 minutes left on the cutting room floor.
Which I watched for this podcast.
And I think that was the only one available. The director's cut is the more commonly found one.
Yes.
But luckily I was able to watch it on... I only watched the theatrical cut because that's all I had time for. And look, after watching this, I didn't really want to seek out the director's cut.
Yeah. At the time we were talking, it is on Stars. So I watched...
Yeah, freaking Shout Factory or Scream Factory. One of those.
Scream Factory,
put out a fucking Blu-ray of this.
So getting back to the making of this, so let's go back to this. So Brett Leonard has a meeting with Bob Shea where Bob Shea is like, I want you to adapt this. And Brett Leonard's like, look, I can't do anything with this story, but I do have a script called Cyber God that me and my wife have been working on. It is now a late wife. Her name's Jamil Everett. They did the script together. And Bob Shea said, cool, let's do it. So Brett Leonard does this movie. And of course, the weekend it comes out, guess who he gets a call from?
Did Stephen King call him? And it was like, speaking of Bob Shea, it's like Nightmare on Elm Street where his tongue comes out of the frickin'.
Well, according to him, it wasn't like that. He got a call from him saying, hey, Brett, it's Steve King here, the author of The Lawnmower Man. And he's like, listen, I'm about to go watch your movie. I'm going to call you right after and let you know what I think. So Brett Leonard's like, oh, shit. Right? Brett Leonard leaves the phone. And King calls back on his answering machine. And this is what he says. He says, Brett, very cool movie. My kids actually really enjoyed it. It's very clever. I think it's incredible. Of course, it has very little to do with my short story. And they're saying it's from the mind of Stephen King. So I'm probably going to sue these bastards. But I want you to know, I'm not going to sue you. And I think you did a great job. And I'll be positive about the movie.
Magnanimous of him.
So he did not really ding the director as much as he just went after Bob Shea.
It's not Leonard's fault.
No, of course not.
That's funny that Stephen King calls Brett Leonard, but never calls like a David Cronenberg or you know, actually really accomplished filmmakers to compliment them or shit on them, whatever suits his fancy. This is the one he calls.
Yes. Although we haven't gotten to those films yet.
Maybe because Stanley Kubrick didn't have a phone. It's like this guy called.
We haven't gotten to those films yet, so maybe he has. We'll have stories about him. But because you know me, I like to talk about how King felt about the movie. So the movie's coming out, and I was super excited for it. This was a theatrical experience for me. I went opening weekend, believe it or not. And there was a trailer. I still remember it to this day. There was a trailer at the beginning of this movie for, guess what, guys?
Let's see, this is 92. Is it also a horror film?
Yes, and I'll go ahead and say it's a Stephen King one as well.
Kind of. I don't know then.
Children of the Corn Part 2. There was a theatrical trailer for Children of the Corn 2 before this movie. And I came out of it loving it. I talked to all my friends about it. When it came out on video, I rented it, showed my dad. My dad was like, okay, what was that? But I devoured this movie. I enjoyed it so much. I devoured it like the main character in this devours grass in that short story. And Matt is right. The story is not great. It is in a book full of interesting stories, you know, where one guy thinks he's being seen by aliens and things like that. I think it has kind of a weird commentary going on with it because the main character of it is in this movie. And what goes on, Adam, is he has neglected his grass for years because he had to sell off his lawnmower. And it's just growing and growing and growing. And his neighbors are making fun of him for it. So he goes and he hires this lawn mowing company. And the guy who's doing it is, as Matt mentioned, he worships Pan, the land god. And he's basically moving the lawnmower with his mind and going behind it naked while eating the grass. And at one point, the lawnmower even chews up a mole or something in the yard. And he's eating the remnants of that as well. And basically, the guy gets chased down by the lawnmower and dies, a lot like a certain character in this movie. That is the story. 8 pages.
Oh, what cocaine, Mr. King?
Yeah, that's what I thought of as well. So, although, you know, if you look at this movie, Adam, I mean, you want to do the Tron series so bad. We should have just included it in that retrospective.
It's or funny because I...
Transcendence.
Yeah.
Yep. I do remember seeing this in theaters. I can't remember if it was opening weekend or not, but this is one my dad had taken me to. And I can't remember which one of us wanted to see it, because as I mentioned, I was a big fan of Pierce Brosnan going back to Remington Steele. So this guy was up on the list, and the rest of this movie, the trailers nowadays look laughable, but in the day looked cutting edge as all hell. So this was definitely a theater watch. I had to be, I had to be about 12 when this came out. You see, early of 92, yeah. So, I mean, I was rife for this kind of sci-fi experience. And I, much like you, I have seen this so many times over the years. When it came out, we had the Laserdisc. Because mm-hmm. we had a Laserdisc player. This movie was a frequent watch for a very long time. And it has been a very long time since I'd seen it. I showed the trailer to my mm-hmm. wife because she had asked what we were doing next. And she went, "Oh, Jesus Christ."
Well, she's kind of right.
Needless to say, unfortunately, I did not get her to sit with me while I watched this. But the trailer is, I'm going to say it's a different experience than the movie, at least. Some of them give you a good idea what's going on, but I think this trailer belies a lot.
Was it a better experience than what she had to see you at the corner of her eye with Mangler 3? Matt, you weren't around when this was released. You were born the year after. When did you finally watch this for the first time?
I think I was under the influence as well. I was told that was the best way to view this. I have never done drugs of that ilk, but I had a full bottle, and I'm pretty sure I went through most of it by the time that this movie finished. And this was the second time I watched it, and I did not do something similar because my body does not respond to alcohol as well as it used to. And I didn't want to feel it when I sat down to record this, although given the fact that it's a sequel, I might make an exception.
So we started off with the New Line logo, which, as I mentioned, I always associate with the Nightmare on Elm Street. Mm-hmm. And this is also, boys, the second week in a row where we have words to read before a frame of film hits. Here, we have a huge warning about the power of virtual reality and how it can eventually lead to a new kind of mind control.
There's something else that this movie did not need, is another way for it to be dated.
Mind control, that's some hippie shit right there. You know?
Well, this was this type of time frame, this was Bush, Clinton, Gore, like anti-media type of sentiments going on as well. This was Tipper Gore putting warnings on CDs and movies. Everything that we were consuming media was bad.
Yeah, this was right before Bill Clinton's carefree 90s.
We didn't even have AOL at this point, boys.
Nope.
There was no internet at this point. At one point, they call it the Neuronet, which, goddamn, I got to give Brett Leonard credit for that. He was kind of forefront with that. But I don't know if I would have gone with the fact that virtual reality causes mind control. But we'll get into that as we get into the
film. Yeah, I just hate unprincipled movies that start with a whole screen of text.
I know you do, which is why I always bring them up.
Very few movies have successfully pulled this off.
Yeah.
And I can't believe this is the second franchise we've done in a row that involves primates wielding firearms.
I thought of that
it is
too.
Amazing how this lined up with another movie that we were just recording about. I'm like, oh, got to place this in a different franchise.
We are determined to do every single thing involving apes. Hell, let's do Monkey Shines next week. What the fuck?
If we do Congo at some point, I'm in.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, man. Get the Dunstan Checks In series coming soon to Percolated Media.
Dunstan Checks In. We open up at Virtual Space Industries, which when they showed a sign, I had to pause the film because it's almost impossible to read. How would you see this off the fucking side of the road?
Can I just say, when you see VSI, did they just shoot at a warehouse and have strobe lights everywhere? Because there's so much fucking gray in this movie.
Well, there's also a lot of blue. And you know what that's from? That's from the cinematographer of this movie, who, by the way, is Russell Carpenter, who worked with James Cameron on Titanic, and he's done a lot of films over the years. So I have a lot of things to say about this movie, but I'll go ahead and say I think it's shot well. Yeah. I don't think it's technically badly made. Like a lot of the movies we've covered in this retrospective.
Yeah, it's competent. I'll say that. I would say it's above that. You know, there's some cool shots in here, and I do like some of the production design, but it's that 90s, like, when people think of the future, they just think of big buildings that are relatively empty except for these crazy death machines in the middle.
We hear Pierce Brosnan's voice warning us about how powerful another set of drugs could make the monkey they are experimenting on. We get some POV shots as we are seeing the worlds the monkey sees. And you know what? In 1992, when I saw this in theaters, this was pretty fucking amazing. I watch this now, I'm like, oh my God.
So there was, and Gary, you'll remember this, there was a virtual reality arcade.
Yes.
Here in the town nearby of Concord. And I can't remember the name of it for the life of me. But you'd go in.
I can't either, but
yeah.
You, me, and Omar spent a lot of time there.
Yep, you'd go in and you'd be sitting in like these egg things and it would completely encapsulate you. And you would play these VR games that were the most amazing thing at that time. And it looked not dissimilar from what we see here. This just took me back to being a kid.
This took me back to the days of when people thought putting on a bicycle helmet counted as VR.
Well, it's not too far off from having the goggles that you put on now.
Yeah, and for the record, I have done those Oculus things. I've done it one time. It was for Resident Evil 7, and it scared me so fucking bad I will never do it again.
This does look like MetaQuest, I'll give you that.
We see New Line Cinema Presents and get a whole set of credits, but no Stephen King's Lawnmower Man, as we saw in theaters. We then see the monkey get out and wander around the laboratory. He focuses on a gun and shoots a guard, which we also see from his POV, by the way.
This turns into a first-person shooter.
It's got Predator and Terminator freaking vision all of a sudden.
It's got the, reminded me of, have you ever seen Dario Argento's movie Phenomenon? That you have a knife-wielding chimpanzee. This one, he upgraded, got a permit for a gun.
I like it. We actually see what he sees. We understand the why, because we're seeing his vision. The monkey's got better vision than Stephen King had in the original story.
Brett Letter said shooting with this monkey was a fucking nightmare. Because you piss this monkey off, he could kick your ass.
Ask Quarterberg when he was making The Fly.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, what a pain in the ass this was. So the monkey focuses on a gun, shoots a guard, and we have his POV to the point where he even focuses on, when he focuses on a person, it tells him whether that person is a threat or not.
It's literally Terminator.
Yes, exactly. He heads in to take out another guard as the film slows down, and then Pierce Brosnan wakes up. Was this a nightmare?
Or prophetic? Like,
yeah.
The weirdest thing about this movie, what fascinates me the most about everything above all else, for a movie that Stephen King fought so hard to distance himself from and ultimately remove, it's amazing how even still, it has so many of Stephen King's hallmarks in it.
I counted 13.
Right away, we got freaking like telepathy or like, you know, premonitions, like the Dead Zone. You know, there's so many things that we'll talk about. It's just so amazing that it's still, for something that he wants nothing to do with, bears so many of his calling cards.
It's got so much of him in it that I'm exactly with you, Matt. It still feels like a Stephen King movie to me.
You've hit a note that I have later on, so I'll say it now that, I have it written down. For someone who threw such a hissy fit, this is one of the most Stephen King films that we've reviewed, and Stephen King wanted nothing to do with it.
All right, so let's talk about Pierce Brosnan here. He's playing Lawrence Angelo, Now, this is 1 year before he would fight with Robin Williams over Sally Field and Mrs. Doubtfire, and 3 years before he would take the mantle of Bond, which the three of us have already covered. And I remember him being on Entertainment Tonight when this movie was coming out, really trying to sell us that this movie would blow us away. I think bare chest and all, brazen complete with earring, is pretty fucking bad in this movie.
Can we just say there's no one that manscapes his chest quite like Pierce Brosnan? Going all the way back even to pre-Remington Steel. I mean, Jean-Luc Picard with that open robe that he wears would be just, yes. I like Pierce Brosnan in this. Like he's.
Do you really?
I do.
You have a man crush, that's why.
And yeah, I may have a man crush on the guy, but he was one of the reasons that I was excited to see it. The earring, look, Harrison Ford has an earring now, so yeah, it's a dated thing. Guess what? I have 8 or 9 piercings in my body. But yeah, there's nothing that screams 90s, even the VR, in this, like a single left ear earring.
Yeah.
But for a doctor / computer scientist that still wears like shorts when he walks into the office, I don't know. I feel like he exudes 90s cool well enough. He just, I don't know, he brings a level of legitimacy to this movie that I don't know if anybody else does.
God. By the way, Jeff Fahey is credited over him. He gets top bill over Pierce Brosnan.
I noticed that, and I'm trying to figure out why. What had he done? Though, admittedly, Brosnan was nothing but TV at this point, but what was Jeff Fahey, of all people, known for to get top billing in this?
He's just the titular Lawnmower Man.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, not only that, but, you know, he did have a moment around this time. He was in Body Parts, which came out the year before, and is another one I saw opening weekend, and by the way, was completely lost because that happened to be the same exact week that they discovered Jeffrey Dahmer's body parts and everything he had stored in his apartment. So that got lost in the shuffle. And yeah, he did have a moment. He was in a little known but underrated film called Sketch Artist, which I really liked. It was on HBO. But after this, he didn't break out. And I have to say, I'm kind of surprised. Yeah, Jeff Fahey had a moment. And this was that exact moment where he could be top billed over Pierce Brosnan. Matt, can you please wake me up from this nightmare of somebody telling me that Pierce Brosnan is good in this?
He's so bad in this that I understand why people were so mad when he was cast as James Bond. Because this also does not help combat the argument people said he was a pretty boy. Because he's got that perfectly coiffed long hair. He's got the earring. He dresses like he lives on a boat in Miami. You know, he's supposed to be a freaking scientist living in like suburban America. Oh God, he is so flat in this movie. And yeah, if this, I understand why people did not want him as Bond, because this does not do him any favors. But I also don't think, like, this character is just not interesting at all.
No.
So he's not done any favors on that front. I also think you could have cast a lot of people in this role and gotten similar types of performances. I don't blame Brosnan, but he's not good in this.
So Larry's flipping through channels and wakes up his wife, his girlfriend.
Well, it doesn't matter long enough because she leaves the movie, so we don't have to answer that question.
Ah.
In one version, she does.
I was going to say, au contraire. In your version, she leaves the movie. In the director's cut, she shows back up, and I will get to her scenes, and boy, did we miss something when she comes back. But yeah, in the director's cut, there's more of a ploy from Angelo to win his wife back, pretty much. And she does come back, but yeah, here she leaves and she never comes back again. So he wakes up his wife telling her that he's had a bad nightmare, and her response to this, to yell at him for smoking in bed.
Oh, she is such a bitch. She has no sympathy for what he's going through at all. It takes everything to the ninth degree. Where she's like, you're self-obsessed with your work, but rather than having a conversation with you about possibly being depressed or needing to get out, I'm just going to leave you.
She serves absolutely no purpose in this. Like, it would make no difference whether he just woke up alone. The way that they portray her in this, just cut her out completely. You excise another 3.5 minutes from this film, because that's all she's in this version anyway.
Yeah, although, to kind of side with her, he is kind of obsessed with this monkey. Like, he doesn't love her as much as he loves this fucking monkey. Every time we see him in the first third of this movie, he's talking about this goddamn monkey.
Oh, he is. And as somebody who's just sat through his 5th, 6th, 7th, or 8th Apes film, I get it. You know, monkeys are cool. But yeah, don't smoke in bed, people. I'm glad I quit smoking. It's a bad move.
Oh, terrible. So Angelo answers the phone and hears that his chimp is dead and that it tried to escape. Now, Matt, in your version...
the version 95% of people have seen. Let's not act like I have the rights to this. I'm not Kevin McClory where I would fight to have sole possession of this piece of cinema.
All right. Well, in the version you saw, this is how the monkey dies. But in the director's cut, he survives, and he's brought back into the movie. Like, almost immediately, he makes his way to Job. And so he pretty much hangs out with Job the entire time. And then eventually the shop comes and pretty much shoots him and takes him out while Job is yelling for them to stop, which I actually think, you know, I'm not asking for this movie to be longer, but I think that's a better version of the story. I think it kind of serves what Job goes through a lot better for him to see the monkey be shot as opposed to the monkey just leaving the movie.
I don't need it because I think we need to get going. Like, yeah, I'd be okay with it, but unless they're going to save his life and, like, permanently affix a VR helmet to his head and make him look like Weapon X, the chimp version, just move on. Like, we get what happened, but just, you know, keep going.
So we see Angelo roaming the halls with this Lex Luthor-looking guy saying how catastrophic it was losing the chimp as it was his key to moving on to human subjects.
Damn it, I made the Lex Luthor... in my notes. Is this everybody's version of a evil businessman in the 90s? Is this Lex Luthor freaking Michael Rosenbaum shave head look that we get around this table?
Well, Matt, you recognize his boss.
Yeah,
right?
I couldn't believe Dean Norris was in this movie. Like,
I could not believe that.
And it looks like he shot all of his scenes in a garage.
I know.
He looks like he's...
And by the way, this is 20 years before Breaking Bad. He looks the exact same.
Yeah, no difference whatsoever. Yeah, this was after Total Recall, where you can't really tell that's him.
Yeah. Now, one line of conversation here, which is actually a nice little tie-in to King, is that Angelo is talking about the shop.
Which is Firestarter.
This is something we're going to be really diving into when, Matt, as you mentioned, we talk about Firestarter and The Stand next year.
It's funny you mentioned The Stand, because I thought of that as well with the Job character.
But all of this, of course, as King has pointed out, is not in the story. So Larry says that virtual reality holds the key to the evolution of the human mind. We cut to Terry, who is Jeffrey Lewis, the actor we saw last year when we covered Salem's Lot, boys. This is Juliet Lewis's dad, who was the guy who played a pretty big role in that movie. Here, he's pretty much a side character.
Juliet Lewis's dad? I never knew that.
Yeah, that's Juliet Lewis's dad.
This guy, like, this is the only time he doesn't play a villain.
Yeah.
Like, he's the villain in so many movies. He's also big, like, he was a big collaborator with Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, he's in a lot of his
movies. Cadillac, High Plains Drifter. Yeah. Who is he in Salem's Lot?
He's the guy who has the gun in his lap. Remember, he turns into the vampire and he's just kind of rocking back.
Oh, the guy in the chair? Okay.
Yeah.
Funniest thing, as I sit here, could this not be the most stereotypically offensive gardener accent he's putting on since Willie from The Simpsons?
Well, I mean, I don't know if this takes place in Maine or not. So this is when we meet Job, played by Jeff Fahey. Now, Matt, you and I briefly discussed Fahey when we did the Grindhouse commentary a number of years ago at the other place.
Oh, my God. That's a deep hole. It's a deep, not even an official entry in this retrospective.
I know. I like the metamorphosis he goes through here as Job, and whether King likes it or not, there's more depth to Fahey playing this character than if he was on his hands and knees eating grass naked, which is exactly what happens in that story.
Oh, God. I think he's horrible. This borders on Cuba Gooding Jr. in Radio territory. It is.
Oh, my
God. You
know,
this is so close to what Tropic Thunder was making fun of.
Oh, yeah. It reminds me of that character,
actually.
This is
Simple Jack. Yeah. This is what he's doing.
Yes.
He is Simple Jack without the buck teeth. And look, he's less offensive early on because this is the thing I hate in these kind of stories where you have, how do we show that they're getting smarter? Oh, they dress better.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh,
we'll
yeah, because that's clearly, I see a bunch of PhD people shopping at Walmart. And this is also the big thing. Like, I think that one of the problems is that his metamorphosis is so rushed. And the only stuff we know about Job is the bare minimum. He's mentally handicapped. Yeah. He is abused by his adopted father / priest. And he gets treated like garbage from everybody. That's all you need to know.
what I completely get here, especially with the two of them together, I'm getting Of Mice and Men. And I think that's what
we're saying. Oh, yeah.
But I think he's supposed to be Lenny. Yep. Which makes
great
me
comparison.
Just later, I'm like, okay, wait a minute. Who does he kill? And, you know, is it accidental? And I'm waiting for his, like, mental, like, God, I can't web it. And yeah, guess what? There's some of that in here.
There
and
is.
For the record, we're going to have a pull quote on the back of this review. Adam Bunch of Frickly Media compares this to Steinbeck.
King would probably prefer that. Job shows Terry a brand new lawnmower, which they built together, called Big Red. We then see a character named Jake, who Job warns about the dangers of smoking by a gas pump. And by the way, he's exactly right. This is fucking dangerous.
Lawnmower right off the set of trucks.
Yeah, and there's gas station for trucks.
Yes.
I mean, between the lawnmower and the characters, that lawnmower is king. That's maximum overdrive. We saw that.
We cut back to the shop, and did anyone else get Superman vibes from this scene where Dean Norris is on the screen and just yelling, guilty, guilty? Or was I the only one? I guess I was the only
Lawnmower
one.
Lawnmower Man compared to Superman, the motion picture by Garrett Collins.
We see Angelo literally floating through a virtual reality game as his wife comes downstairs and cock blocks him by unplugging it. She tells him that he was supposed to take her to the city today, and he apologizes only to tell her that he's going through changes and that the technology she is afraid of will change the world as they know it. She's not buying it, though, and leaves the room.
And the movie.
And the movie. In certain cuts. I do like this conversation, though, because she's just like floating, flying. What's next? Fucking?
And for anybody who knows internet, yes. That's exactly
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, what do you think virtual reality is really there for, especially when men are doing the research?
When they can combine into dragonflies, but we'll get to that. We cut to Job, complete with overalls, mowing the lawn as his buddy Peter comes out to greet him. Now, Peter is played by Austin O'Brien, who had quite a few notable roles in the 90s, not the least of which was the unfortunate position of following huge star Macaulay Culkin as a love interest in My Girl 2. And, of course, he was in a movie I actually hope to cover one day, Last Action Hero. Yep.
I mean, this kid really, they were trying to make him the next Macaulay Culkin.
They were.
That's where I've seen that. I haven't seen that movie, but I've seen the trailer and clips so many times, I didn't realize where I'd seen the kid.
Yeah. And he is as insufferable here as he is in Last Action Hero.
Yeah, he's pretty bad in both. He was also in a terrible movie called Prehysteria, where he was with dinosaurs.
Yeah,
so
it was
bad.
Like one of the first movies they made to try to capitalize on Jurassic Park,
where
they find like dinosaur eggs in a temple. It's all about them like hiding the dinosaurs. It's one of the worst kinds of like kids' films you'll ever see.
It is.
And then he kind of disappeared. Like, he did The Lawnmower Man 2, I know about. He did some TV, and then he basically stopped acting. Which makes sense, because I don't think he ever found it to begin with.
Here, Austin O'Brien as Peter is showing Job some new 3D comics that he picked up. We see Angelo make himself a drink and stand at the window looking at Job. We know his wheels are turning at this point. Peter's dad comes home and yells at him for leaving his bike out.
Yep, we got the alcoholic, abusive
yes.
parent, Hallmark Stephen King.
Check. Yep. We didn't get to another check, Matt. We cut to the church.
Yeah, like, this is fucking Carrie, where he's getting...
Yes, it is.
He might as well... Mm-hmm. The only reason he's not locked in a closet is because they couldn't afford one to shoot in.
As a priest who looks like Sting, the singer yells at Bugs on the altar, as well as Job's name. He makes his way up to Job and tells him he needs to earn his keep. He says, God's lessons help you learn best, and he gives Job a whipping. Now, in the director's cut, this is much different. Here, it's kind of played to, oh, you didn't spray, so we got these bugs, so it's time to whip you. In the other version, it's kind of more drawn out, where he's just kind of saying, look, we need to be good for these people who are coming by to see the church, and so he gives them a whipping. This character could have been left out. I fucking hate this character.
What I get was, because of something that happens later on, is I get the rapist priest that... is the feeling that I get going on here. And not just because of him, you know, taking advantage of this simple-minded innocent, but we get a cowboy catalog a little bit later on with bare-shirted, you know, jean-wearing guys that makes the priest uncomfortable, that in retrospect, I'm thinking that this is just the stereotypical abusive priest that is going to get what he's got coming to him.
That's literally where my brain went as well.
Carolyn comes in and says that she's leaving and tells Larry that he should probably stop drinking. He says that she has no idea what he's going through, and she just leaves saying, goodbye, Larry. And as Adam mentioned, and she leaves the film as well in this version. He locks up and once again sees Job mowing the lawn, and he realizes who his new subject will be. So the fact that these drugs went bad with this monkey means it will go well with a human?
Yeah, remember the monkey right. was just protecting its young because it had a baby. Wait, shit, wrong movie.
Wrong movie.
Yeah, Angelo is, if you want to look at it, I mean, is just as much of a villain taking advantage of Job, at least at the beginning part of this. Yeah, he's got innocent or, you know, noble means, but they always do. But to jump to, I'm going to do human testing on this mentally retarded farmhand is pretty fucking evil.
I don't know. I disagree with you there. I don't think Larry's intentions are evil or bad in that way.
I don't think his intentions are, but I do think that the act itself is, yeah.
Larry tells Job that he has some cool games in his house, and if he likes to play them.
You're talking about, like, pedophilia vibes. That's what I was getting from this.
What's up downstairs? I get a popsicle. I got video games in my basement.
What's weird about this is Larry is doing this under the guise of he just wants Job to play some games. But what does Job think he's going to accomplish by coming in and doing this? And how would he know that Larry has the quote-unquote best games if they're so dangerous?
I'd love to know what Pierce Brosnan's wife slash girlfriend slash lover thinks of letting a mentally handicapped person and the neighbor's kid come into their house and play games with them in the basement. Was she married to Jerry Sandusky?
She's finally out of the house. He doesn't have to deal with that. That might have been the window right there. So Job starts matching symbols.
So they can't get out.
Job starts matching symbols, and he's racing Peter in a very cool-looking game at the time. Yeah, so this is like, what, pole position with virtual reality with these freaking teeth that look like the teeth from the Langoliers, which we're going to cover here in a couple years.
Not to mention, you get the freaking seven sign symbols, like, flashing before his head.
Yeah.
Like that alone, think of the religious aspect back into it. Because I'm thinking signs of revelation is you get those flashes before him.
I think the games in this VR system throughout this movie was sponsored by Joel Osteen with all the Christianity metaphors in here.
Peter tells Job that it's just a game and he leaves. Larry tells Job that he has other games that can possibly make him smarter. He then tells him that he can make him smarter, but only if he wants to, and he can't tell anyone. Yeah, this is giving off some pretty terrible vibes here.
Oh, God, this movie made me laugh harder than a lot of mainstream comedies do nowadays with all the... with all the subtext and joke. I mean, you could write a book about, or write a script making fun of this movie.
Don't tell your mom and dad about the games we're going to play down in my basement and the sex swing.
Don't forget, boys, this movie made a shit ton of money. $150 million on a $10 million budget.
Well, I think a lot of that was because Stephen King's name was attached to it.
Exactly. Yeah.
But look, the technology that you see, it was cutting edge at the time. I mean, we'll make fun of it. We make fun of it now and call it dated, and certainly it's almost an antiquity compared to now, but at the time, like, you were not seeing stuff like this when you went to the theater.
Mm-hmm. So Job is cleaning the Jesus statue, and Angelo tells him that he can't tell anyone what he's doing, as Angelo tests his heart and shoots him up with drugs. He starts simulating a game where he's inserting power into his brainstem, and we're getting lots of flashes here.
Oh, God, if you have epilepsy, this movie will put you in the hospital.
It should have had a warning, for sure. We're getting a journal entry from Larry where he says it's too late to turn back now, so he's already starting to see some warning signs of what he's doing to Job. Meanwhile, Job and the neighbor across the street, they flirt by eating at one another.
This woman is just...
We get a little montage of Job's tests as Larry is on a treadmill and Job is now beating Peter. As Peter says, finally, some real competition. And Angelo tells Job, congratulations for graduating to the next level.
Oh, the shit on the treadmill made me think of South Park when Cartman pretends to be mentally handicapped and there's that virtual of how to walk like a retarded person.
We're now seeing Job shirtless as he looks in a mirror and the priest walks in on him. The priest says that Angelo must be feeding him the devil as Job stops the whip from hitting him and tells the priest, you know you shouldn't hit people.
This is when it started to feel so much like Carrie. Like, we get a little bit more and more, sure. But this here with the church and this, this just felt, I mean, I was waiting for the priest to throw him in the closet like Carrie and his mother. Like this, I'm like, okay, I see where we're going.
And this is where I also start to feel the cuts, because I know they're there, because this arc feels very quick and not as gradual as I thought it would be.
We cut to the shop as Lex Luthor Light tells Larry what he's done is very impressive. Larry tells Lex Luthor that he needs access to the main lab to go further with his treatments. We see Job at a gas station in new garb and a haircut as Marnie tells him that she's looking forward to having her lawn mowed. I'm sure she is.
He's so got, it's like Clark Kent taking off his glasses and people realizing he's Superman.
He's got a haircut. He's got dingareens going on. He's got it going on here.
I was reading somewhere that they were going to go with a different color with his hair, but it didn't look right. He didn't look very good with the haircut and style, but they think this does. It's such a weird... You ever get those guys that look like they're purposely wearing a bad wig as they get older? That's what this fucking mop looks like on his head.
Yeah, one of them was president.
Oh, jeez. I tell you, I see guys who think they're cowboys all the time in Reno, and it's just so funny. They remind me of this dude, where they think they're cool, but they're really not.
It's once a week on roleplay night. Relax.
We do get, we didn't get a lot of the classic, King bullies, but we get one here at this gas station.
Yes.
The redneck.
Yep. Jake says there's no way she would want Job and takes it out on him by hitting Job down. Job tells Angelo that people can tell he's starting to change, and Angelo responds by telling him not to call attention to himself.
I also love how this guy doesn't know how to throw a punch. It looks like that scene in Goodfellas where Ray Liotta beats up the neighbor, and he's not even punching him, he's hitting him with the side of his fist.
Yeah, up to $10 million, you'd think they could afford a coordinator here, but no.
No, I think this is one of those movies where it was first take only.
First take go.
Yeah.
Kept going.
They head into the shop as Job lays eyes on the main contraption.
I've seen this at Barnum and Bailey Circus, the spinning...
this gyrosphere? Yeah. I tell you what, though... Again, compliment alert. I think the set here is pretty impressive. I like the way this looks. I like the way it's lit.
So basically, yes, this film is dated. I expected to be put off by the datedness of it more than I am. I'm not nearly as angered as I was expected to be. I go along with almost every scene.
Angered, he says. He says angered. Yeah, you guys seem like you're having a better time watching this than the last couple of weeks. The last couple of weeks were a little rough.
This movie is hysterical. This is the kind of bad movie I enjoy watching, where I spend the whole time saying, how did people think this was good?
You know what? And I'm watching this movie for this podcast. I'm watching this. I'm like, why did I think this was so awesome at the time? I was bragging about this movie. Now I see it from my dad's point of view, where I'm like, what the fuck? Speaking of point of views, we're seeing the game from Job's point of view as he and Angelo are dressed like Tron characters. Adam, you must have liked this.
It's, you know what? Kind of cool little outfits looking here.
Lex Luthor Light, he takes a look inside, and we're hearing Angelo change the Brave Wave levels within the game. We then see Job cutting the lawn again, this time shirtless. He's hearing noises and sees Marnie as she invites him in for lemonade. And I love how Terry pushes him to go in. He's like, yeah, go ahead, Job. Go fuck
her. Yeah, as if he would know what to do.
Exactly. Yeah, you talk about uncomfortable.
Yeah.
This?
It's like he's, it's wrong on her end, too. It's just...
Yeah, everything about this is wrong. She starts making out with him, telling him to give her his tongue, so this whole thing's uncomfortable.
Yep.
And then he gets fresh with her, and she tells him how hard he is and how soft she is. All of this is oh my God, you're seeing someone fuck for the first time, and it's so uncomfortable. That's one thing about this movie that surprised me coming back, boys. I forgot how fucking horny this movie is. This movie's really horny.
Really is, especially for not showing any nudity in it, which in the early 90s would have had no problem. And with the rating, it's chased in its nudity for no reason other than just because. But yeah, it is a horn dog film.
I'm thinking around this time, imagine Paul Verhoeven got his hands on this movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, don't forget, boys, don't forget, the early 90s for horror in particular was bad for ratings.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll talk about it with blood and whatnot later. But this, I believe that this, all this sex stuff is probably what got it the R rating, and they had to chop a lot of the R stuff out. I just was surprised at how much sex is in this. I did not remember it being that way.
And I'll speak to that point, too. I'm amazed that this is R rated.
Yeah.
Because other than two or three words, I see nothing in this to earn an R rating.
Well, this stuff's pretty hardcore. She takes them down and they're going at it really hard. And Job is learning that the first time is actually pretty great. So.
Well, it's all downhill from there.
Yeah. I don't know why that got me so good.
Because you're not married.
Meanwhile. What's that?
Because you're not married yet.
Meanwhile, Lex Luthor Light is asking Angelo to let his Tess out of the closet. And by the way, all right, to talk about how dated this is, this guy takes these blue drugs and replaces them with red drugs because that always goes well.
Well, I'm screwed.
Work for Morpheus.
Ah, we'll get there soon, my friend.
Yes, we will.
More experiments are being done as we cut to Job driving in a truck with Peter. They head to the local diner, and Job tells Peter that he's given up comic books, and he's giving all of them to Peter. I love how this is how we can tell that Job is cool, because he's giving up comic books. Definitely a different time.
That's what a lot of people did in the 90s.
That's what I'm saying.
That was a bad period for comic books. And I also love this is where he turns into Carrie with the telepathy. And
yep.
He also talked about how horny this movie is, where he undoes the toothpaste and makes it squirt out on its own.
More Carrie vibes with that.
Yeah, oh, this, I mean, Carrie vibes. I'm surprised we didn't do this in the Carrie retrospective.
I can't fault Job. That was around the time that Rob Liefeld was huge. And then once you read three or four of his comics, I would have quit comics too.
Yeah, Todd McFarlane made me do the same thing. Fucking hack.
Of course you guys go there. Fucking hack.
Thanks, Image.
Job then gets a huge headache, and he sees in waves as he looks around and is in obvious pain. We see Job talking to Angelo, saying that he doesn't want that pain again, and Angelo is just impressed by the fact that the treatments stopped, yet he seems to keep getting smarter. We go back to a meeting on Krypton. Is anything of importance said in these scenes besides them trying to persuade Lex Luthor to be more persuasive with this?
Yeah, what does the shop actually do?
Yeah.
Like, because they say this they're very vague about the project. It's all about, like, obviously it's for weapons, but is this planned for all of their soldiers? Is this planned for the people who build missiles so they always hit their targets? Like, what is the purpose of this actual project?
And again, we'll dive deeper into the shop when we talk about Firestarter.
Yeah, both versions.
all three versions. More fucking with Job and Marnie as Job has another attack. We go back to inside the shop as Angelo and Job are doing a lot of spinning in circles in these gyrospheres. Job is having convulsions and tells Angelo that he's seen God.
The picture of Stephen King.
Oh, I'm surprised Brett Leonard didn't include that to make right. Angelo tells his journal that the treatments are now out of control as we cut to Job's opening a mirror with his mind and causing toothpaste to leave the tube, as you guys mentioned earlier.
Garrett, I got a question for you. In the director's cut, do they have the same journal entries, or was that something they...
Yes.
Okay. Because to me, it felt like something they did to explain away cutting this film down in editing.
Yeah, that's all included.
Okay.
And he sounds as bored as Harrison Ford does with those Blade Runner narrations.
You can really tell he was waiting for a call from those Bond producers, can't you? He's doing this movie. We see an advertisement for a 1-900 number. Remember those, Adam?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, this movie's so horned up, it might as well be for a sex hotline.
Exactly. As Marnie comes in and he tells her that he can read her mind. He takes her to the shop because apparently he has admittance now.
Yeah, he's got a card key.
Yeah, he's got clearance.
Worst security ever in this place.
You're not kidding. And then he tells her that this will be the best ride of her life. And here they can be anything they want to be. And here, my friends, is cybersex.
Yeah, this is fucking Demolition Man.
Well, did this movie invent the term cybersex? I kind of feel like they do.
I feel like they do because some of the other terminology that we use here with, like, database networking, which that's the internet, and some of the other stuff was really kind of first fleshed out, at least to the public, fleshed out here, you know, with this one. Like, these were terms and stuff that the general public hadn't been familiar with.
What'd you guys think when they interconnected and then they fly away as a dragonfly?
Okay. I'm laughing because it's 2024, and I had to put myself 30 years ago, 32 years ago, and think about it. That shit was cool to see then, and I do think in the scope of this movie, I think it fits, and actually, I it doesn't bother me. Everything that you could be here in this virtual world and coming together and Job coming into his own, she doesn't fit here, but the rest of this, I gel with it. I do.
Guys, gotta stop saying the word coming in reference to this movie. I think it's definitely cool at the time if I'm putting myself back in that, you know, in that time frame, but as it stands, it feels very, like, this feels very Forrest Gumpish with all their scenes.
Marnie says that she wants out, but Job says nothing can hurt us in here, and he's pretty much raping her as he turns her into a bug in that reality and spits blood at her, and she shuts down. Ouch. He tells her that he couldn't stop and that he didn't mean to hurt
her. God, every line you are saying in these narrations, you could put in the porn parody of this movie.
One of the words of the priest.
We see the lawnmower moving around without being pushed, and this element is indeed in the story, as the character in that story could move the lawnmower with his mind. Somebody wanted to say something.
This movie's turning me into a 15-year-old where all I can think about is sex.
Job's hearing Marnie from across the street and wonders what Angelo has been doing to him. Lex Luthor Light says that they cannot cut the hands that feed them. They need to make what they're doing public. We then cut to Angelo putting Job in the shop as Job moves more objects with his mind, which Lex Luthor Light witnesses. He tells Angelo that nothing they have been doing is new and that this technology has allowed him to recover knowledge through virtual reality. Here we go with the dangers, boys. Angelo starts feeling pressure in his head, and Job says the treatments need to continue. We see Angelo tell his journal that he fears for Job's sanity. He goes back to the shop with Lex Luthor Light, and he gets angry at the inclusion of Project 5 inside a human, which he finds out. Angelo storms out of the office, saying that he's heard enough. And Matt, this goes to your point of, does Pierce Brosnan want to be here?
I think he got a great sales pitch on this movie, and then when he realized what he walked into on set, he's like, I've made an enormous mistake.
We see Job insert a CD and drive along the highway as he gets inside the shop and takes more injected shots. Lex Luthor Light enters Angelo's room and says Angelo needs to change his behavior, and all the money he's using to research is dirty money. Luthor Light then says that they're going to take Job in because the shop director wants a personal demonstration of the project. This causes Angelo to take out Luthor and then head out.
Softest punch I've ever seen.
I know.
I'm like, really, this is James Bond?
This is James Bond in 3 years. We cut to Job getting very dizzy as Angelo is stopped by a guard. Angelo takes him out, though, and grabs some keys, giving the room service guy the gun and telling him to keep it on the guard. Job makes a visit to the priest, this time decked out in his black Tron suit, Adam. And we see a set of effects that have aged very, very poorly as the priest goes up in flames. Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're, good call.
Shit looks like it's like the opposite of when Bruce Greenwood melts in X-Men.
Wow, did this look bad.
It looks like what you got from a fire effect in a video game at the time.
Yeah, for sure. And Matt, is it just me, or from here on out, we get a slasher film, right? We've turned this into a slasher horror film.
Oh, from here, this turns into Friday the 13th, A New Blood. It's entertaining, though. Like, the one thing I'll say about this movie, I was not bored.
Yeah, the last few weeks, they've induced a lot of boredom. But you're right. I'm not having a bad time with this either. All right, so this has turned into a slasher film where he's taking out everybody who's done him wrong, right?
Yeah.
Pretty much. And it's funny. You know what? Give credit where credit is due, Suicide Squad. We got our bubble people right here in this one.
Well, we're getting there. We're getting there. We haven't gotten there yet. I have things to say about that.
The Honey Patrol.
We then see Jake wander out with a cigarette in hand as Job stands with a mower by his side. Jake calls him a strange motherfucker as Job just stands there and sends the gas nozzle his way. The nozzle ties him up as shit goes in his eyes, and Job says, the lawnmower man is now in his head. And we're seeing, like, images of this lawnmower man, mowing a lawn in his head.
This is the part I laughed at the hardest, when it's literally running over his brain.
Yeah,
I almost had to pause the movie. I was laughing so hard. Not just because the effects are so terrible, but the fact that this movie feels like it has to literalize the title.
Oh, we're getting there, too. Peter's dad is watching what I was watching back then, some WWF wrestling.
Yeah, and I think he was watching a Von Erich match, so this is our tie-in.
No, that's actually Tito Santana.
Loved it. Before we get here, Job going through the city made me think of Carrie walking through the city, destroying everything in her path. Like, it's very much the, I'm going to walk around and kill everybody that's done me wrong.
Matt, I love how this retrospective has educated Adam on the King tropes.
Oh, yeah. I'm so happy about it.
It warms my heart.
Five fucking times.
So, Job approaches Pete's dad with this lawnmower and takes out some furniture as well as Peter's dad himself as it chases him through the house, and we get a POV shot of it heading straight for his head.
Why did you just do, as laughable it is, do the mental thing of him being a telepath and being able to kill somebody and have that lawnmower be a metaphor, an image, something that way, to literally the next death being a literal lawnmower death?
You know what I love about that critique? It's literally the only element in this movie that's in the story, and you're making fun of it.
Like, as silly as it looks, I love the thought of the lawnmower chewing up dude's brain. There's something about that, of being in his mind and chewing it up with a lawnmower, that I go with from a gory, horror, sci-fi element. The mind control physical lawnmower, it's back to Maximum Overdrive. And it, to me, it just undercut, I can't believe I'm going to, it undercut the brilliance of the mental lawnmower.
I, again, this is in the story. This actual scene right here, he kills him with the lawnmower in that story with his mind. And you're putting it down. I just love that so
much. The only thing that was missing is he goes into his head and he's got a frying pan and an egg, and they do the drug PSA.
We then see Angelo pull over as cops tell him that the remains of the body were placed in the bird bath. Again, this scene and what cops are saying here was straight from the story. Word for word.
It's an accident. It's a mistake.
And this cop, by the way, was in so many fucking movies from back in the 90s. Like, we've seen him in a lot of stuff.
Oh, this guy in, like, Ace Ventura.
Yeah,
Siege. Demolition Man.
Uh-huh. Demolition Man, yeah.
I think he actually owns his cop uniform, so he kept getting hired because he costumed didn't need to dress him up.
He was one of the cops in, I think it's Halloween 5.
Wow, I didn't see
that. He's one of the cops. He's in Twin Peaks.
Yeah, Twin Peaks is what I remember from him, too. The cop lets Angelo in on every crazy thing that happened last night. And Larry himself knows that only one person could have been responsible. But in the middle of this conversation, Joe must have some influence over them because the cops change their minds and call the murders accidents.
Like Batman Forever with the Riddler's mind control. Yep, suicide.
Yeah. I do like that we're hearing Matt laugh this week as opposed to last week where it was just straight anger the entire podcast.
I think you can get a set of tone that can influence how you can enjoy something. But it's also, you know what, this thing isn't 2 hours. At least the version Matt and I watched, thank goodness.
I saw 2 hours and 22 minutes and I said, fuck that.
Nope, not that one.
We cut to Job going up to a house in the game as Angelo rips the goggles off. Though with a new boost, Job is now even more powerful. He tells Job that he needs to let Angelo help him, and Job responds that he doesn't need help. Job says Angelo has created a monster, and to conclude his revolution, he is going to inject himself into the mainframe of every computer and become pure energy.
This comes out of nowhere.
He says once he's entered the neural net, the sound of him being reborn will be the simultaneous ringing of every phone in the world.
Well, looks like the Wachowskis watched this movie. It's the end of the Matrix.
So we're seeing the bad guy say his plot, right? Kind of like a Bond villain.
Yeah, this whole, like, you know, becoming pure energy and infecting the neural network, this comes out of nowhere.
It truly does.
Jeff Bezos is like, I like this idea.
Angelo is trying to convince Job that he has had a psychotic break, as Job finds that the shop is on its way and Angelo has completely betrayed him. He then ties Angelo up, puts on the goggles, and says he is now about to witness the impossible. All right, Adam. You've been circling this drain for the last 20 or so minutes. Here we go. We then get more good, bad effects as this huge head representing Job shows up. And it just puts me in mind of the way Zur in The Last Starfighter showed up in the middle of a starfighter meeting in that movie.
God, I was wondering where I'd seen it before. You're right.
They try shooting this big orange head with bullets, but he just moves his head and he turns them into a bunch of dots. Go ahead, Adam. You go first. You've been aching to talk about this.
One, I can't believe how goofy this feels with, yeah, this floating head. I mean, you know what? He is God. He's Zor-El here. He's in this floating head. It shows up. But I remember thinking, you know, back when I was 12, oh, what a really cool little death of these guys. Now, is it laughable? Yes, it's laughable. But I can't help but think, frickin' Suicide Squad, and how much David Ayer made those villains look like these bubble-headed bastards. Oh, shit, it makes me laugh.
I was thinking of that giant head. I was thinking of Andross from Star Fox.
You know what? Unlike the fire, which they were trying to sell us as being real, I find a certain amount of charm with the way these guys just kind of turn into molecules and they just turn into dots right in front of us. I like these deaths. I thought they were cool.
Because I feel like they're digitized. It doesn't bug me as much as like the fire, which, you know, has got a realism, can't believe I'm saying that in this film, aspect to it. But this one, it feels like they're digitized and blown apart.
One thing I want to agree with Matt on is the fact that I don't think Fahey's playing this correctly. He's playing this so straight-faced. We need puns. We need something that makes this feel like he's having fun here.
Yeah, he needs to feel, this character now needs to feel larger than life in his performance.
Yes.
To convey that. He should just, with the tone of this movie, he should have become Super Freddy, or the Freddy that uses the power glove, because this is a fucking New Line movie.
I'm shocked that Shay didn't go there with this. So Job says by the year 2001, there will not be one person not hooked into the mainframe. Boy, were they prophetic with that, weren't they?
Yeah.
And he apologizes that Angelo hates what he created. More Krypton meetings, and we get a close-up of a mouse saying that he saw Job take out two of his men in a way he has never seen before. You know what I love about this movie, too? This Peter character has been in and out of this movie frequently. And in the director's cut, there is more flirtation with Angelo and the mom character, Peter's mom. But here, again, she comes out of nowhere. This is funny. So, the fate of Brosnan's wife in this movie. In the director's cut, she is dressed as a 50s housewife. And in that movie, she, again, Brosnan's trying to make good with her, and she's brushing him off. And at one point, while all these guys are being turned into molecules, she comes out with a gun and tries shooting them. And she gets taken out by one of them. That's how she dies. So Peter unties Angelo, and they all head for the showdown at the shop. Angelo enters the mainframe and puts a computer virus inside of it. Angelo happens to come across some explosives as soldiers surround the shop and are attacked by those dreaded computer bugs as Terry and Job enter without hitting a one of them.
Yeah, suddenly it turns into asteroids. You can't hit anything.
Yeah, asteroids. There you go. These bugs, oy vey, they're pretty bad.
Yeah.
Job tells Terry that he has to go as Terry is shot. Job screams, which causes the soldier who shot Terry to shoot himself. This is where the R rating came from, too, I think, little effect here.
It's funny. They couldn't remember what size barrel was on that gun because he hits him with a sniper rifle and then tries to find a way to kill himself. And you could tell he could not hold it and actually pulled the trigger at the same time. So it edits to just his head blown.
Good catch. He enters the office of Lex Luthor Light and turns him into a bunch of dots as well.
I like that he doesn't. It's done different than the other ones. That it's almost like a constant state of blowing apart and coming back together. There's something really disturbing about that version that he does.
Peter and his mom give Angelo a ride to the shop, and I so expected Peter to stay in the car as instructed. We see Job enter the gyrosphere as Angelo sets some explosives, and we hear Job say, "I'm in!" And this is the image I think of when I think of the Lawnmower Man, boys. This of virtual God Job saying, "I'm God in here!" Again, these effects kick ass in 1992. I was so freaking impressed by these when I watched it as a 14-year-old. Job is having trouble getting out as Angelo finds him in a vegetative state on the wheel.
That sucked clean. Yeah. And that sound of him like being slurped into the fucking internet.
Yes.
Ugh. I mean, it's like classic New Line, but just that. Yeah. Ugh.
And this little dummy on this wheel, it's, I think this is another change in the director's cut. Because here, I mean, you could so tell it's a dummy. And in that cut, it's a version of Job as God in the virtual world is what he sees here. They knew to change that in the director's cut. So Job still can't find a way out as Angelo approaches him and says he's not even human anymore. Job tries to find the code out from Angelo and gives him Superman laser vision to keep him in line. I like this little effect inside this world where he's given this green laser vision to Angelo. Meanwhile, Peter enters the facility and Angelo pleads with Job to save them all. And Job lets Angelo out to save him. So there is a heart. Job still has a heart. He wants Peter and his mom to be saved.
But he's not on the surface. He's not evil. I mean,
yeah.
He's, you know, mind-expanding drugs who hasn't been there and been abused by a religious damn it. Yeah, this is a lot of he's about to become Neo.
I thought this was unbelievably schmaltzy for a movie that was not this up until this point.
Yeah.
Like, did Frank Darabont come in and direct this part?
I was thinking Mick Garris.
Oh, that too. I mean, I don't know who's a worse actor, this kid or Cortland Mead. It's pretty close.
Maybe if there was something with the kid where he had hurt the kid's feelings, you know, and then now he's trying to show that he still loves the kid.
Yeah, maybe he burned the comic books with his mind.
Peter's mom finally wakes up. because she fell asleep in the car. As Job opens the door for Angelo, they run out of the facility as it explodes around them in slow motion.
I thought this was the 90s, not the 80s.
Yeah, this was like, Angelo just kind of puts these explosives around. Does he know when exactly they're going to explode and where they are? Like, it's just, none of it makes any sense.
Congratulations for that now single mom getting herself a bond, though. Way to go. Upgrade.
Until she gets tired of his bullshit and leaves him like the last one did.
Job finds the access door as everything blows up around him. We get one last journal entry from Angelo as he takes responsibility for what happened to Job and says that if used correctly, the technology will free man, not enslave it. As he, Peter, and his mom start heading out, they hear not only Angelo's phone, not only the neighbor's phone, but every other phone in the world ring in unison as credits roll on The Lawnmower Man. You know what? I like this bit of Twilight Zone-ish ambiguity of the ending here. I thought this was pretty cool.
Yeah, same.
Yep, and I'm right there with both of you. I liked it a lot as a kid. It was one of those first experiences I have of that kind of ending. And as an adult, it still worked out for me.
And that does it for The Lawnmower Man, a very fittingly animated discussion. Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give The Lawnmower Man? Yes, just The Lawnmower Man, not the author's name. Adam, you go ahead and go, sir.
For a movie that I was looking forward to discussing it with you too, but was not looking forward to actually watching the movie itself. I've seen this movie a number of times when I was younger, preteen and teenager, because it was cool back then. This movie's not cool anymore. The effects are not cool. It's dated as all heck, and that's part of the problem with some of those early 90s films is by trying to visualize the future, they really, really dated themselves. On the other hand, the themes and story and that parts of it kind of shine through and keep going. For Stephen King suing and winning twice, which is unheard of in Hollywood, to take his name off this film, this is one of the most Stephen King films that we've seen, and that blows me away. Yeah, the effects works is shoddy, but it's you know, the 90s, so I can't hate on it all that much. But I still remember the access denied, access denied, access denied, access denied, access denied. Like, that came flowing back into my brain like I was Job in that gyrosphere. The acting is cheesy as all hell. It plays like a TV movie. This is nowhere near one of the worst Stephen King adaptations we've viewed, though. In fact, I had more fun watching this than most of the Stephen King movies we've discussed. And maybe it's just because I look at it as the cheesy, schlocky pseudo-horror that it is. I think you could go full horror with it and be a better movie, or full sci-fi and be a movie. As a blend of the two, it ends up being neither. I think the themes in the story still work. King's influences are throughout this film. It's dated, but I think it holds steady until the final 30 minutes, and the CGI goes off the cliff so poorly, but in a loving way. I know I'm going to give this the highest score of the three of us, because I still enjoy this movie. I'm giving this a 7, and I am not doing that ironically. I'm taking it as the movie that it is. I'm not going to damn it for its overuse of CGI. I still think for a non-Stephen King movie, it's one of the better Stephen King movies we've seen up to this point.
7. Wow. I we have broken Adam, Matt. We have broken him to the point where he has given The Lawnmower Man a goddamn 7. Matt, where you go, sir?
Well, unlike Adam, I have to take the movie for how I perceive it, and that's something that's uneven, certainly, and has a great hook to it, which is why I think so many people keep thinking they're the person to make it. But maybe there's just some kind of fundamental flaw. You know, there's the we didn't really talk about what this is borrowing from. Short story called The Flowers for Alderaan or something, which it really takes this premise, as did an episode of Star Trek, specifically the 60s original Star Trek had an episode where Where No Man Has Gone Before, where it's basically about, there's two crew members who get EMP abilities and they perceive themselves as godlike beings. It's very much that. Having said that, I think this movie is immensely entertaining, but I do think it's also very, as the director's cut likely shows, chopped up. I think Job's arc feels very elementary, like it's basic coding in screenwriting, where it's, all right, we're going to give you the essentials you need to know about this character, but his arc is going to be over really fast, and it's going to feel rushed. I guess it's better than the opposite of this transcendence, which takes way too long to make its point. In comparison to the last couple of Stephen King movies we've watched, namely the Mangler series and some of the other ones that we've done, like Graveyard Shift, this is definitely the one I enjoyed the most. But it's also not a great movie, so when I have to balance the two, on an enjoyment level, it's I would watch this again, but in the grand scheme of Stephen King properties, despite having so many of his calling cards, I'm going to settle on a high 4. It is what it is. I enjoyed watching it, but I'm not going to... I don't think it's very good.
This movie is the definition of... It's better to be a good house in a bad neighborhood than an amazing house in an extraordinary neighborhood. After the hell we have watched in the past few weeks, we all got a little bit of enjoyment out of Graveyard Shift, but those three Mangler films were tough. And I think the fun we had watching this is kind of the result of that. I find it so ironic, as the fan of Stephen King, to come to this movie after years of being away from it, and realizing, even though the author himself sued to have his name removed off of it, this is much more of a Stephen King movie than he wants you to believe. And that was the huge takeaway I had while watching this. Maybe it's just because I've been reading him left and right, you know, preparing for these podcasts and going through and listening to commentaries and things. But the man has more influence in this movie than he does the majority of the films we have covered in this retrospective. I think this is more of a Stephen King film than last week's film, for sure, Mangler Reborn, or Mangler 2, for that matter. As a whole, though, I'm a little more on Matt's side than Adam's, where I gotta take this as an exercise in filmmaking, and I think the simple fact is that while he has a lot of the technical savvy and a lot of the tech speak down, I don't think Brett Leonard is a very good director, and his later career definitely proved that. And this movie takes a lot of things that he just cannot do, like getting from point A to point B. How does this character end up in a different place than what we saw them before? And certain things like that, where he has a really tough time steering this ship. And as a result, you know, we also have Jeff Fahey, whose performance I have mostly praised, but by the end of it, I was kind of tiresome of his just complete self-seriousness of this role. Pierce Brosnan in a comically bad role, and Austin O'Brien, well, we've said our piece on him, and we'll get to him more next week. But I am going to step right between you two. I'm going to give this a 5. I think there's a certain amount of 90s charm that goes with this movie. But don't get your hopes up, people. This, if you haven't watched it for this retrospective, it is not a good movie. It's a pretty bad one. But as somebody who grew up with it and loved it as much as I did, I think there is something to take away from it. And I think if you can get past the unwittingly bad effects towards the end of the film, specifically the fire with the priest, it can be a fun watch. But goddamn, just leave your brain at the door, because this movie will slam it inside. So 5 out of 10 for me on The Lawnmower Man. This discussion went different than expected. Will next week's discussion go different than expected? Next week, we have another movie in the Lawnmower Man franchise, the only other movie in the Lawnmower Man franchise, Lawnmower Man 2. Matt, what are you expecting when we see Matt Frewer take the Job role next week?
Jesus. I have no clue what to expect. If it's anything like some of these other movies where they had to some semblance of justification for a sequel, I think I'm in trouble.
I got no expectations. I didn't.
Have you seen it? I mean, as a noted fan of this, you haven't seen this yet, huh?
I've never seen it. You know what? I couldn't stand Max Headroom, so...
Ooh.
Yeah, so guess what? That's pretty bad for me. So you got someone who kind of made this movie watchable for me, and you got, in the sequel, somebody who made it unwatchable for me. So, never seen it. Never seen anything about it, never watched a trailer, a TV clip, nothing that I can remember. I've seen the poster, or I've seen the, you know, cover art, and that's as far as I've gotten. So, I'm not looking forward to this. Whatsoever.
Even with the fun you had this week, you're not looking forward to next week? You don't think next week will be a 7?
You know what? Spoiler alert, no. I don't think there's any chance in hell I'm giving next week's film a 7.
All right. Yeah, I saw this movie one time, and... Adam, it was at a time when it came out when I was still working at the video store. So I took it home one night and I think I watched it and never turned back. So this will almost be a first time watch for me. I don't remember Austin O'Brien being in that movie quite enough. Actually, I do, because he had long hair. I do remember that. But that's all I remember. But we'll get to that. And then by that time, boys, we will have one story left in this retrospective.
Oh, good.
In the night shift.
Right? Quick, yeah. one more movie.
One more story left.
One more movie.
Too bad there's a lot of corn to hoe when we get past this. But until next week, when we discuss Lawnmower Man 2 Beyond Cyberspace, this podcast is mine. I am God here. Thank you, gentlemen.
No one could have comprehension and attention at that speed. No one.
I did, Dr. Angelo. As a matter of fact, I think my retention is better at higher speed. Normal speed was only putting me to sleep.
That's impossible.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively on Percolated Media.
Very funny. I'm laughing my ass off.
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
I've synergized a tremendous amount of data, and you and I have proven that most functions of the brain are simply lying dormant, waiting to be awakened.
And if you like this review, please head over to percolatedmedia.net or search your podcast streamer of choice, for we have individual reviews such as Knock at the Cabin, The Black Phone, Megan, as well as additional blockbuster franchises like the films of Martin Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio, the DC Extended Universe, Stephen King's ongoing collection, and many more.
I realize that nothing we've been doing is new.
And if you'd like to hear the boys talk about the film adaptations of Carrie and The Shining, please head over to www.bingemedia.net and click the Aftertaste tab.
No way to deal with these fuckers.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Looks like you made the list, Nardello.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
You need to be led, just like everyone else is a basic need.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Clean up this, Warwick!
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
I ain't one of them burning baby flashback fuck-ups you see Bruce Dern plans to quit your grinning.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
You better watch what you're saying.
I don't think so. I think from now on you better watch what you're saying.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
Now, do you have any idea what a PC rat eats? Try raw American whole mayo, thank you.
show's over.
But I think I'm going to show him to Madison this year because she's been into horror movies and doing all that. Because she wanted to see it. I'm like, no, you need to watch the movies first because then you get it.
Yeah. I need to get a couple sessions with her. I need to educate her.
Hey, she says The Thing is one of her favorite movies. I did good.
Oh, that's.
And we saw it in theaters.
Yeah, can I make her my stepdaughter? Okay.
As I'm starting to get college applications, yes, go ahead. I will send you the bill. She turns 16 in a couple months. Next month.
Jesus.
16.
My goodness. Wow. Matt, you ready?
For college applications, fuck no.
Oh, by the way, in 2 weeks, so that'll be the week of like the 26th, I won't be around. We'll be down in L.A.
Okay. We're
I know.
Getting a lot ahead right now. So, plus, I think me and Matt are probably going to be recording
good,
Mad
I'm
Max.
I'm a fan of a lot ahead. Anyway. As we all are.
Yeah, because by that time we'll be
you'll be on Max, I think.
Yeah, should be. But I want you to know, I'm not going to sue you, and I think you did a great job, and I'll be positive about the movie.
Magnanimous of him.
Yeah. We literally, because we take these in advance, we literally have breaking news about Stephen King. Don't worry, he didn't.
Oh yeah,
he didn't die.
No.
But we did get an official announcement about the Salem's Lot remake.
Yep. Which, yeah, more on that later. But we hear Pierce Brosnan's voice warning us about how powerful another set of drugs could make the monkey they are experimenting on. And I have to ask, we already talked about the monkeys. Never mind. We were talking about how Planet of the Apes coincides with this. So I'll skip that line.
We are of the Apes coming soon.
And then he kind of disappeared. Like, he did The Lawnmower Man 2, I know about. He did some TV, and then he basically stopped acting. Which makes sense, because I don't think he ever found it to begin with.
Much like Macaulay Culkin.
Oh, come on.
Well, no, whatever.
Macaulay Culkin just forgot how to act once he aged up, and he got... It doesn't help that his brothers are just... especially Kieran is a much better actor.
He morphed into Kieran, yep.
We get a little montage of Job's tests as Larry is on a treadmill and Job is now beating Peter. As Peter says, finally, some real competition. And Angelo tells Job, congratulations, we're graduating to the next level.
The shit on the treadmill made me think of South Park when Cartman, Cartman pretends to be mentally handicapped and there's that virtual of how we walk, how to walk like a retarded person.
The quintessential South Park reference on the Percolator Media.
Well, I think this movie feels like something South Park would make fun of if they have it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.